From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in snowy Dublin, New Hampshire.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. No snow yet, at least here and now. It was snowing in Pittsburgh this morning when a highway bridge collapsed on the day President Biden was already scheduled to be there to talk about, well, infrastructure. Remarkably, there were only a few minor injuries. Pittsburgh's mayor, Ed Gainey, a Democrat, says the bridge collapse shows the need for the infrastructure money in the bill the president signed.
You know, at the end of the day, we could have had some serious injuries.
And it was just 2 years ago that we had Route 30 collapse just a couple of years ago. Another major artery. So
at the end of the day, this is critical that we get this funding.
Biden's trip to Pittsburgh is part of his effort to get out of Washington more as the rest of his legislative agenda remains stalled in Washington. Let's dive into our Friday Politics Roundtable to talk about this and about Biden's Supreme Court pick. Aisha Roscoe is NPR White House correspondent. Rick Klein is ABC News and political director. Hello to both of you. Happy Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Aisha, to you first. Biden's poll numbers, of course, are down. His party, if history is any guide, is likely to lose seats in Congress this midterm election. Does getting to pick his first Supreme Court justice give him a chance, a bit of a chance for a political reset, an opportunity to change the narrative?
It gives him a chance to get something done, and it also gives him a very big chance to fulfill a campaign promise. He promised that he would put a black woman on the Supreme Court. He made that promise in particular to James Clyburn, the congressman from South Carolina, who was pivotal in Biden getting the Democratic nomination. And so he is able with this, because we all know Supreme Court justice nominations and, you know, getting them approved, they suck up all the oxygen in Washington, D.C. Everyone is talking about them. All eyes will be on it. And it's a chance for him to actually get something through Congress and to, you know, fulfill a promise.
Rick, the president said he would announce his nominee within a month. Now, the ideological balance of the court, as we know, is not going to change. Could this mean that this is a lower drama affair this time around?
It's actually possible that we could have a de-escalation in the long-running pitched battles that we've seen over Supreme Court nominees. Not to say that conservatives are going to back down. They'll use it as a fundraising ploy for sure. They'll also use it to put some Democratic senators on record. But you look at the combination of factors, as you mentioned, the balance of the court isn't changing. Democrats have the votes anyway. And we're 9-10 months away from the midterm elections. All of it points in the direction for potential smooth sailing. Now, I know that court nominations can go sideways in a lot of different directions, but to hear President Biden talk about his process yesterday, trying to get the advice of even some Republican senators, in addition to ultimately their consent, it's possible that this is a much lower temperature affair than the battles that we've become used to during the Trump era and even during the Obama era.
Aisha, we have talked a lot, and you have talked a lot, about Joe Manchin, the swing Democrat in the Senate who has blocked much of the president's domestic agenda on voting rights, on the so-called Build Back Better bill. But here he is talking to West Virginia Metro News on a Supreme Court pick.
Whoever he puts up will have experience, and we'll be able to judge him off of that. But as far as just a philosophical belief, no, that will not prohibit me from supporting somebody.
So if this is the case, Aisha, does this give Biden political space to pick a staunch liberal to the bench?
Well, it gives him some space, and I don't think it's too surprising that Joe Manchin is saying that, because even though Joe Manchin has in some ways emerged as a thorn in the side of the administration, that's on issues like big spending bills, climate change, things of that nature, changing the filibuster, obviously. But when it comes to, you know, like things like picking, you know, a Supreme Court justice, you know, Manchin has been someone who has voted the party line. Like, he hasn't always been the person gumming up the works. So I don't think that's that surprising. I do think that the administration will want to get someone who is very experienced. And you look at Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was confirmed by the courts or confirmed by the Senate just last year. I would have to think that looks pretty attractive since she was confirmed with 3 Republicans as well.
On the Republican side of the Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell famously blocked former President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland from even getting a hearing in an election year. Here's what McConnell said about this time.
So look, I'm going to give the president's nominee, whoever that may be, a fair look and not predict on today when we don't even know who the nominee is how I might vote.
At the same time, McConnell said in a statement, quote, the president must not outsource this important decision to the radical left. We mentioned that the ideological balance on the court won't change. But if the Republicans wanted to, Rick, could they torpedo Biden's pick?
Almost certainly not. Not by themselves. The 50-50 right. Senate means Kamala Harris as the vice president is the tiebreaker. McConnell's tune would be a lot different if he right now was the majority leader instead of the minority leader. And it may be because he knows he may be the majority leader soon that he's saying that. Now, spoiler alert, I do not think that Mitch McConnell is going to vote for Biden's pick. Almost certainly. I just don't see it. But there may be a couple of his members that do, and he might actually be okay with that because it doesn't change the balance of the court. And as to the point about outsourcing, it is rich coming from McConnell, given how former President Trump essentially outsourced his list to the Federalist Society, the conservative group that looks at judiciary nominees, and picked from a list, quite literally. But regardless, I don't expect that this is going to be back to the days where you could get 90 or even 80 votes like Justice Breyer did in confirmation. But I don't think McConnell is going to throw down everything he can to try to stop this. And the bottom line is he almost certainly can't, even if he wanted to.
So, Aisha, back to you. I mean, what's your bet? Do you think Biden has a good chance of getting quick action in the Senate without lots of political drama? What's your view?
You know, it's hard to make a bet in Washington. But I think that if there was something that could get done quickly, this is the sort of thing that likely could. But there are, as always, there are caveats, right? Like, as long as, you know, they pick someone who has been vetted, someone who has experience, not someone totally unexpected. And as long as nothing comes up in that process, right, of going through, you know, the record of the person and everything that they've said, whoever does get chosen, I think that it is possible in what the Senate has said. Democrats in the Senate have said they want to get this done in about a month, just like with Amy Coney Barrett. They want to follow that model. I think it is possible.
Okay, let's turn to foreign policy now. On Russia's threat to invade Ukraine, the president is ramping up his response, moving from diplomacy toward potentially moving American troops to Eastern Europe to counter potential Russian aggression. Rick, is there a political dimension to this that Biden might get a foreign policy bump, as it were? We know his poll numbers are low.
There are still bipartisan rumblings around a sanctions package and about a response, but I also think it's worth noting there's deep Republican divisions as to how involved, if at all, we should get in this conflict. There's a wing of the party that, including many people loyal to former President Trump, who think that it's a mistake to risk any kind of American blood or treasure in a conflict that doesn't directly involve us. So you could see Biden actually in the middle of different wings of the Republican Party. I think, look, this is it's a tense time. It's hard to say how it's going to end. We haven't seen any significant de-escalation yet, but there's an area around foreign policy that's traditionally been something that Joe Biden is more comfortable in. It allows a president more flexibility than some parts of the domestic agenda, and I think depending on how it's handled, how it's judged, it could begin to move the needle a little bit. Look, Joe Biden needs some wins. I think if he can stare down Putin and win, that's a big benefit.
And Aisha, Rick mentioned Republicans to some degree being split on this issue. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, some of this is a product of the time that we're in, where you do have these very conservative voices, like, you know, commentator Tucker Carlson, actually, you know, being sympathetic towards Russia. And you saw the start of this during the Trump administration, where you had Trump, who at least when it came to rhetoric, was very sympathetic to Russia. And that is not traditionally what conservatives and Republicans have been or where they have stood when it came to Russia. So I think that you're seeing some of that split, and some of it may come from, you know, just ideological and the fact that you did have a former president in Trump who was not as vocally against Russia as you had in the past. And also the idea that the U.S. has been in a lot of wars and that has fallen out of favor, and the idea that the U.S. should not, you know, be as aggressive on the world stage as it has in the past.
So lots of focus on Russia, on the Supreme Court. But Rick, very quickly, in just a few seconds that remain, any chance for Biden and the Democrats to salvage their legislative agenda in 2022? Voting rights, social programs, semiconductor investments? What do you think?
The votes just aren't there now, but winning begets winning. And I think the Supreme Court nomination gives the Democrats an opportunity to remind themselves of where they're Democrats, begin to establish some unity. Realistically, very little of the agenda seems plausible right now, but you never know what it looks on the other side of a big victory, if that's what they get.
Victory begets victory. I like that. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Ayesha Roscoe, NPR's White House correspondent. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 2022 Sundance Film Festival wraps up this weekend. It is a chance for filmmakers to show their movies and maybe cut a deal to get it shown around the country. So let's talk now about some of the most exciting films coming out this year. With Ty Burr, former reporter at the Boston Globe, he now pens the Substack newsletter, Ty Burr's Watch List. Ty, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Scott.
And Ayesha Harris, co-host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ayesha, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, Ty, let's start with a film that made news this week. Navalny is a film that profiles the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. It debuted at Sundance just hours after the Russian government put him on their list of terrorists and extremists. What is the case that this film makes for his side of the story here?
Oh, the movie makes an absolute open and shut case for Putin's government poisoning Alexei Navalny, because there's a remarkable scene where, because Navalny, who's incredibly charismatic, I wish we could have sound clips in the section, but none of the Sundance films have media out there because they're all, you know, they haven't been released. They're trying to get distributors because he's so charismatic. There's a scene where he is working with a computer, you know, dark web specialist, and they get the identity and the phone numbers of the assassination team, and Navalny calls them in real time the camera, and three of them hang up. He's pretending to be like a mid-level administrator asking why the mission failed. And one of them basically tells all. And it's just astounding to hear what he says. And everybody on screen is kind of like holding their heads. They can't believe, you know, and whoever the guy is on the other end of the phone, he is almost certainly not alive anymore. That's just one of the things that makes this movie really remarkable. And Navalny is an incredible presence and very much involved in the making of the film.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, Ayesha, I want to talk to you about a film that seeks to change people's minds in a way. It's Brainwashed, Sex, Camera, Power by Nina Menkes. Tell us about this.
So Nina Menkes, a few years ago, gave a couple of talks, and this movie is based off of those talks and incorporates these discussions around the ways in which filmmaking has primed us to look at women in a certain way. She really breaks down the different ways in which women have been objectified, the way in which misogyny is rampant within films, even our favorite films, and how we can appreciate some of those films, whether it's a movie by Hitchcock, Orson Welles, Spike Lee, but also find some issues with it. And so she really goes through using so many examples. There are over 100 different clips that she really digs into. This is the way the male gaze works. She also is interviewing a ton of really, really smart people about this. Lauren Mulvey, who actually is famous for coining the term male gaze, is also featured in it and interviewed. So I really love this film. I think it will actually change people's mind, or at least make people see filmmaking in a different way, in the ways in which women, in the most subtle and sometimes very overt ways, are objectified and dehumanized.
Ayesha, is there a scene that really makes the case that Nina's making?
Absolutely. So she's talking about not just sort of narratively the way these things work, but also shot by shot. Like, she's going frame by frame. And so she uses an example from Raging Bull, where you have the Robert De Niro character and the Joe Pesci character, and this is the pool scene, and it's one of the earliest scenes they have with the female character. And you see the female character, you never hear her speak, but you always hear the male character speaking while she's bathed in this, like, wash of light that makes her look ethereal and, like, this sort of object. And the fact that you don't hear her speak, Nina Menkes says, that can contribute to the ways in which, in the real world, we tune women out. And so there are moments like that that are just really, really persuasive.
Yeah. Boy, that jumps out the way you describe it. Now, both of you have the film After Young on your list of favorites. Ty, tell us about this.
This is a movie that, in plot, pricey, sounds like it might not be much. It's about a family in the near future that is mourning its android, its family android. The director is a guy named Koganata, who made a wonderful film called Columbus. It stars Colin Farrell as the father of the family and Jodie Turner-Smith as the mother, and Justin H. Min as the android, Yang, who has been brought in as an older sibling to the couple's adopted Chinese daughter. So he's like an older brother, and he just stops working, and the film becomes a very pointed and insightful and emotional look into grief and memory and what makes us human. And I went into this movie not expecting much, and I was practically weeping at the end. It achieves a profoundness of emotion that many movies don't get to, and it does it with a very light touch. It's really quite unusual.
Grieving a digital being. Aisha, does it work for you?
Oh, it absolutely does. I've been waiting since Columbus for Koganata's follow-up, and I don't think it disappoints at all. I think that not only about grief and memory and loss, but it's also a very interesting study on sort of cross-cultural dynamics and the limitations of those dynamics. Because as Ty sort of alluded to, the reason they bring this droid in is so that they can they hope that their Chinese adopted daughter will be able to learn more about her culture because they can't provide that for her. And so it's really, really beautiful. And I, too, was like, by the end of it, just like kind of a wreck, emotional wreck.
Aisha, one more film on your list is Nanny, about an undocumented nanny from Senegal. And it has some supernatural elements.
I wouldn't say necessarily supernatural. So the filmmaker and the screenwriter is Nkiatu Jisu, and she is pulling from a lot of West African spiritual folklore. And so I'd say it's more a little bit more folklorish, and there's a lot of imagery of water. And what I love about this is it's a thriller in a ways that is sort of commenting on what it means to be a Black woman and a Black immigrant who has to deal with this privileged rich couple in New York City. But it's also about her trying to adapt to her surroundings while also trying to bring her young son from Senegal into the country. And so seeing her, it definitely has elements of horror movies where a woman becomes undone in many ways. And as she has to deal with the pressures of working for this couple while also hoping to bring her son to the country, she kind of we get into her psyche in ways that are just so fascinating. And I think the visuals are stunning. I think Jisu has a real handle on storytelling through visuals and in suspense. I was really on the edge of my seat throughout most of this film. And it was one of my favorites of the festival.
Yeah, I would agree with Aisha's mention of Nanny. And I was actually struck by some of the criticism that it doesn't meld the realistic story and the horror, when in fact, as she points out, it is folkloric. It's, you know, drawing on tales of Anansi and Mamiwata, and really incorporating them very, I think, organically into the story. The one other favorite that I had was, and I wasn't expecting it to be a favorite, it was Cha-Cha Real Smooth, which is, if you had a blueprint for a Sundance indie about a drifting young man after college who falls in love with a slightly older woman, this movie like fits the template so neatly. I was tempted to write it off, but the writer-director star is a guy named Cooper Rafe, and he is absolutely charming, and the movie is absolutely charming, and I hope it gets released, and I hope people get to see it.
Finally, Sundance this year, like last year, was entirely online. How does that change the experience for you and for the filmmakers and their aspirations? Ty?
One thing I think it does, and Tabitha Jackson, the Sundance director, has spoken about this, is that it takes Sundance out of the mountains and out of the sort of rarefied, privileged world of people who can pay to get there, and brings these movies to the rest of the world. Wow. And I think that's great. And I think that Sundance going forward will be hybrid. Even when we can go back to it, there will be online screenings. And I think that is absolutely all to the best. It benefits filmmakers as well, because they're seeing their work get out there in a way that benefits their careers and helps build word of mouth outside the hothouse of Sundance. And I think that will help with distribution deals as well.
Yeah, I concur with all of that, although I do, and I, another sort of aspect of it for from a critic's perspective is that I'm able to see so many more films in this way. Usually when I'm in attendance at Sundance, I might see maybe 8 to 10 movies. That's all I have time for, because you're going back and forth from, you have to go from each theater to theater, and then you're also doing a ton of interviews in person. And so it's hard to move around there. And this year I was able to see, the festival's not over yet, but so far I've been able to see 23 movies, which is... Yeah, which is a lot. But
oh,
that's,
I'm one
that's
behind you. I've done 22, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So it's that's a great thing. But I do also hope that next year and in the years coming up, we can go back to being in person, because there is something special about just being able to see these things in a theater undistracted. As much as I love being able to watch these with my dogs, it's I would love to be able to be in the theater too.
That's a really good point, because there is nothing quite like the experience of being in a theater in Park City when a movie connects with an audience, a big audience, and the screen goes black and you can just feel the audience swell up in a reaction that you just can't, obviously you can't get at home. And it's a feeling of discovery. I've had it happen a couple of times with Beast of the Southern Wild, for instance, Whiplash with another, where just the audience was welded into one experience of just being bowled over by this vision that this director was having that I've missed for 2 years, and I would look forward to getting it back.
We've been talking to NPR's Aisha Harris and film critic Ty Burr about Sundance and what's coming this year. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Scott.
And we will have their entire lists at hereandnow.org.
We have new numbers from the Department of Commerce today on the state of the U.S. economy. Consumer spending was down in December for the first time in months, while inflation continued to climb. Michael Regan is here to make sense of it all for us. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, good to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So lots of data on the economy out this morning. What are the key takeaways?
Well, I think I would first preface it by saying that the economy really is still very strong. Before these reports today, we learned just yesterday that at the end of last year, gross domestic product grew 6.9%, which is really super strong, you know, compared to recent history, even before the pandemic. But these numbers today do sort of confirm that consumers are feeling the effects of both the virus, the renewed flare-up of the virus, and this high inflation. As you said, adjusted for inflation, consumer spending actually fell 1% last month, which is not a good sign. Our economists here at Bloomberg and other economists, though, do believe that it's probably just a temporary slowdown because of the virus flare-up, and you know the cases seem to, knock on wood, with any luck, be peaking. But it, you know, it definitely a setback for the economy because of the virus and inflation.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about inflation. Up almost 6% last year in 2021. Do these latest numbers give you any clearer picture of what's driving these high levels of inflation? You mentioned Omicron. What else is driving it?
Yeah, it's really, you know, it goes back to the old laws of supply and demand, and you have issues on both sides. On the demand side, you had a lot of people who saved up a lot of money during the pandemic because, you know, they were stuck at home. They had to cancel vacations. They simply spent less. And spending patterns have changed a little bit, too. People are buying more goods, physical goods like furniture for the home, with all this pent-up savings. And that's one end of it. On the supply side, though, obviously we're still dealing with all these supply chain issues that you hear about, whether it be factories that closed because of the virus or the ports being just overwhelmed and sort of being a bottleneck, trucker shortages, that sort of thing. So it's really a combination of both the supply and the demand sides that I think a lot of economists and, you know, government officials had hoped it would be more resolved than it is right now. But it's all proving to be a lot slower to be resolved than people were hoping last year.
And what about consumer confidence? How are people feeling about the economy right now? What do we know about that?
Yeah, this is really interesting given, you know, unemployment is almost back to the lows before the pandemic. That GDP number is really high. But the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment numbers came out today. They were actually the lowest in more than a decade since 2011. And if you look inside the nuts and bolts of the report, it is that inflation that most people are pointing to as sort of sapping their confidence. It's also a very big political divide. Republicans are much more pessimistic about the economy than Democrats, which is an interesting phenomenon.
Interesting phenomenon indeed. Okay, that's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, talking to us about the latest numbers in the economy and consumer confidence. Mike, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As the Ukraine crisis has unfolded, we have heard voices from Kyiv, from Washington, from Moscow. But let's check in now from a community watching the events closely. Ukrainian Americans. It's estimated there are about a million living in the U.S., including Yuliana Kletsen. She's an attorney in New York City. And when she was 9, Kletsen moved with her parents from Ukraine to the East Village. In 2014, when the Ukrainian Revolution began, she went with her father to join the protesters. Yuliana joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Scott.
So you, of course, don't speak for the whole Ukrainian-American community, but what's your sense of the read among Ukrainian-Americans at this moment? I mean, we've heard that Ukrainians in Ukraine are kind of going about their daily lives, a little surprising.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that Ukrainian-Americans are probably a little more terrified and a little bit more on edge in some ways than Ukrainians in Ukraine. You know, we're watching all of this sort of with horror. And for Ukrainians in Ukraine, it's been 8 years of this, of escalating tensions of, you know, will he or won't he? And it's you know, one death threat and after another for them. So while tensions have risen in Ukraine, I don't think they've risen necessarily to the level that spectators who aren't used to this being part of their daily lives.
Sure. Are you in regular touch with your with family members there?
Yeah, I am.
What do they tell you?
In a lot of ways, the war has brought us closer since 2014, 2013. You can't take anyone for granted.
Yeah, what did they tell you, your family there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it varies a little bit by region. I think the West, you know, feels a little bit more calm, while the East and Kyiv is definitely on higher alert. I mean,
yeah, much closer to Russia, much closer to Belarus. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so you know, they're within an air missile. Kyiv is within an air missile from Belarus. So, you know, men have got their duffel bags packed. They've got, you know, small bags with warm clothes and non-perishable food packed for you know, the eventuality that they get called to fight.
Yeah. You're very close, I gather, to the Ukrainian-American community in the New York area. Help us understand this bond that so many Ukrainian-Americans have to the ancestral homeland. Not all communities, immigrant communities have this?
I think for a lot of Ukrainian Americans, I mean, they didn't leave Ukraine as a free country. They fled the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So supporting a free Ukraine has been really important to them.
And do your parents, know if any of your grandparents are still living, do they talk a lot about this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. The politics are such it's the top of mind for everyone. I mean, everyone is politically active, politically aware. Everyone votes. It's a result of living in a country with such enormous political instability and then, you know, has such direct impact on your life. So people are very politically active and politically aware in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. You and your father went to join protests in 2014 when many Ukrainians were trying to force the government to ink closer ties to the European Union. Why'd you go and what happened?
The protest started out as a cry for, you know, Western values and Western integration and European Union integration, but they really spun into the size that they you know grew into when the police responded, when the government at that time in place responded with tremendous violence to the protesters, which in Ukraine was in free independent Ukraine was really unheard of, and that's kind of what outraged everyone so much. So we went because it felt like a moment. It felt really important, and so we went out there and we participated in like a caravan type of protest specifically, where we drove out to the homes of particularly powerful politicians at the time, and you know, we honked our horns and chanted outside their homes, and most of the people that participated in that particular protest were then hunted down by, I don't know if it was hired Russians or the Ukrainian government in place at the time, but you know, they took down everyone's license plates and called you know their homes and blew up cars afterwards.
Wow! So did they call you back in the States, or did they call your family members in Ukraine?
So the car we used was registered to my grandmother's home in the West, about 8-9 hours away from Kyiv, and yeah, they called my grandmother and harassed her.
Wow. So was your family nervous when you and your father were protesting? If your family is like mine, they have harrowing experiences with authoritarian regimes.
You know, it's funny. My dad and I weren't nervous. A different grandmother on my maternal side, she called when we were on our way to do this, and you know, she was freaking out. She's like, "They're like, what are you doing? Like, you know, this is like, they're gonna come after you." And I was like, "Oh, grandma, like, it's fine. The KGB is dead." So you know, I think the older generation.
Your grandmother surely has stories, yeah, of her own.
Yeah, yeah. Her husband actually was sentenced to 25 years in the gulags in Siberia when he was 16. His entire family was shipped out there.
Wow. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I mean, is that something that she talks about in a moment like this, or is this something that I have family members in my family who went to the Chinese version of the gulag, and people never talk about that?
Yeah, they don't talk about it. I mean, up until very recently, she wouldn't talk about it at very tight-knit family events. I mean, she would say, no, they just, you know, sent him to Siberia because he was literate and his family was relatively wealthy. It wasn't because, you know, he was handing out pamphlets for a free Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. You're several years older now. As you watch what's happening now in Ukraine, more than 100,000 Russian troops at the border, what do you think is at stake?
Ukraine is a test case, right? It's been a test case for a lot of its history. I think a lot of Belarusians look at Ukraine and they think, well, sure, we're not happy with our government. We don't particularly want to go down the Russian sphere of influence, but look at what's happening in Ukraine. So, you know, they sit back and they sit quiet. Maybe people would feel more comfortable standing up for democracy and putting their lives on the line for democracy if the world stood strong with Ukraine in this instance.
And can I finally just kind of ask it this way? What do you think is at stake for Ukrainian identity and heritage?
Not much, to be honest. We've always been under threat. You know, whether it was the Holodomor in the 1930s, from Stalin-era politics.
Oh, the famine imposed by Stalin in the 30s.
Yeah, that's right. Or if it was just general Soviet-era politics of no Ukrainian language, no Ukrainian religion, you know, no Ukrainian history, just one sort of Soviet identity. We've kind of constantly been under threat, and I don't think this war, no matter what happens, is going to change how Ukrainians see themselves.
Yuliana Kletsen is a Ukrainian-American attorney living in New York City. Yuliana, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
This championship weekend, four NFL teams will play for spots in the Super Bowl. In the NFC championship game Sunday, it will be the Los Angeles Rams against the San Francisco 49ers. And in the AFC, the Cincinnati Bengals will try to stop the Kansas City Chiefs from making a third straight trip to the Super Bowl. Here to break it down is Fox Sports Radio talk show host Andy Furman. He lives right outside of Cincinnati. Andy, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I tell you what, the town is going crazy. I never thought anything could galvanize a city as much as professional football. But I guess when you hadn't won a playoff game in 31 years, and last year this team was 4-11-1, and they're one win away from going to the Super Bowl, people are going ballistic.
Okay, first of all, let's play a little sound from the game last weekend.
Harris, the snapper. Huber will hold it. 52-yarder. Sweeps the leg. He's got it! Cincinnati wins! They are going to the AFC Championship game for the first time since 1988.
It's amazing.
Andy, not since 1988. Tell me the mood in Cincinnati this week.
Everything is orange and black. Everything is Who Day. The newscasters on the TV stations in Cincinnati are all wearing Bengals garb. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's kind of fun to see that. They're not wearing the shirt and ties, and the women are wearing Bengals sweatshirts. The three network stations and obviously the Fox affiliate, they're in Kansas City right now and basically doing a great job for the Chamber of Commerce in Kansas City. Not talking much football, but there's a lot of people in Cincinnati making the trek to Kansas City. And I just placed a phone call for the airlines to how much it would cost for a ticket to go from Cincinnati to Kansas City. Well, if I wanted to go next week, it's $150. If I want to go today, it starts at $440.
All right, translate for the rest of us. Who day?
It's who they think going to beat them Bengals. I think it's an offshoot of the New Orleans Saints years ago. It was who dat. And now it's who day, D-E-Y. And there's a city in northern Kentucky called Dayton, Kentucky. And it's who day, D-E-Y. And they're spelling Dayton, Kentucky today, D-E-Y-T-O-N. The mayor of Dayton, Kentucky proclaimed it who Dayton day, who day.
All right, let's talk about this. This team, for those who might not have watched enough of the Bengals or ignored them at their peril, they're going in to play the Chiefs this weekend. I mean, who are the stars, the key persons to watch? I imagine it starts with the QB, Joe Burrow.
It starts with Joe Burrow. Everything starts and ends with Joe Burrow. I mean, if they keep Joe Burrow upright, they're going to win this ball game. They really are. They beat the Chiefs back in Week 15 in Cincinnati, 34-31. But here's the key. And people say, who's going to be the team that's going to win this game? Who's going to move on? It's quite simple. It really is. And I'll tell you why it's simple. The team that has the ball last will win this ball game.
both of these teams can score like crazy.
Yeah,
right?
They can. That's why the one who has it last will probably win this game. The similarity between Cincinnati's divisional round win and their win against Kansas City back in week 16, I think it was, or 17, it was they were the last team to touch the football. The game is going to be a shootout between Burrow and obviously Patrick Mahomes, and if the game ends in a touchdown or a kick from Evan McPherson, the field goal kicker, it doesn't matter. Whoever has the ball last will probably win this ball game, because I think it's going to be a shootout, and the one who has it last will win this ball game.
So how to stop Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City? He pulled out another miracle, as we know, last weekend, and Kansas City has this huge home field advantage at Arrowhead Stadium.
Yeah, that's a great question. It really is. I think that, number one, it's very difficult to stop him because no one stops Patrick Mahomes. I think one of the keys has to be, really, is keep him off the field. That's the key. So how do you keep him off the field? The Bengals have to have a good running game. You want to keep Patrick Mahomes off the ball field, and that's the key right there. Other than that, it's very difficult to stop him. As I say, no one stops Patrick Mahomes. He's an amazing man. He's a magician with the football.
Yeah. Okay, one other game this weekend, of course, on the NFC side, the Los Angeles Rams against the San Francisco 49ers. What are you watching for in that game, and do you have a pick?
Well, obviously, the 49ers have the Rams' numbers. They beat them the last six times they played. It's an amazing situation. The 49ers are built to run the football. They're built to maintain possession and to wreak havoc up front with their defense. I really like them, but I think it's about time the Rams come to play. There's a lot more at stake for the Rams. They mortgaged the future for this year. They got Von Miller. They got their quarterback, Matthew Stafford, who basically has led the league in interceptions. But I think the Rams win this game. Stafford's playing well. As long as the defense can slow down the ground game, quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo will not beat LA. The Rams are going to win this game. Write it down, 24-20 in a nail biter.
And coming back to the Cincinnati-Kansas City game, what's the score there going to be?
Sorry to say this, I just think that Cincinnati playing in Kansas City is a downer. Jamar Chase of the Bengals wrecked the Chiefs in that December game.
The wide receiver for the Bengals.
The rookie of the year. He caught 11 passes for 266 yards and 3 touchdowns. That's not going to happen again. It won't. I think the Chiefs win this one in a close one in a shootout. The Chiefs 35, the Bengals 28.
Andy Furman, Fox Sports Radio talk show host in Cincinnati. He's talking to us from just outside Cincinnati. Andy, enjoy the weekend. Thanks for the time.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
Who day indeed. I'm Anthony Brooks in Dublin. Have a great weekend, everyone.